Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the allegedly least corrupt country in the world. I don't understand, in a world run by criminal bankers, how such a thing could even exist, and if it did exist, how meaningless it would actually be at the end of the day. My very special guest today is a woman who has, who is quite humorous, but except it's only one bone of her body that that manages to get that up. Other than that, she's a very, very sharp woman with incredibly serious information to have bestow upon us, if you will. Her name is Sophia Smallstorm, and she creates no small storm, mind you. Sophia, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure what all that meant that you just rattled off about me, but I'll just...
Assume that it's something really good and complimentary.
Right, right, I know. That's how... And why is it that everybody has a very special guest? It's never my special guest or my guest. It's always my very special guest.
Because if everybody was just a special guest, then it's not really that special. But if they're all a very special guest, then it is very special.
All right, well, I think we should vary the adjective. Extremely special guest. Actually, it's an ad.
In fact, we could do something else. We couldn't even use special, all right? We can even get rid of that word altogether. Our amazing, fabulous guest, Sophia Smallstorm. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, but if I flub the interview, then I won't be amazing. But anyway, that's the challenge. So you've implanted a little challenge in me. So
either that, or we've helped to build your confidence by knowing that you have a receptive host who actually is really receptive to your ideas and allow you to open up.
Hey, come on, you barely know me.
That's the whole idea.
Yes. So anyway, you know, shall we get into what I suggested right before you started recording?
Sure. We were talking about money, weren't we? The money game.
Yes. You were moaning a little bit about having some money or some problems that only money could solve. And I said, well, then you should play the money game. And so let me tell you how to play the money game. I read about it in a book. I don't know if anyone can buy this book anymore, by a man called David Cates, C-A-T-E-S. And the title was Unconditional Money. And it was actually sent to me by a literary agent that I once had. And I read this book. The first half was phenomenal. The second half was not so good. But I ended up ordering a lot of them. And I passed them around. Because from that book, I invented the money game. And he described something similar that he had done, but I took it a little beyond what David Cates wrote about. And so this is what it is, basically. And it changed my life. All right? So we're all ready for that. So what you do is, every day, you keep a mental note of the good things that happen to you. And they can be very innocuous. They can be very, you know, things that you wouldn't notice ordinarily, except maybe just in a millisecond, and say, that's nice. And you actually start paying yourself for these things. So I called this, at the time, I called it my spiritual money, right? So the way the spiritual money works is, you just go about your day, and let's say you have a great conversation with somebody. You pay yourself for that. You pay yourself, whatever, $50, okay? And then at the end of the day, you'll write down, great conversation with so-and-so, $50. Let's say you're taking a walk and you see an absolutely lovely... I love calla lilies, and when I see them growing in people's front yards, I think they're just beautiful. So if I saw a calla lily growing, I would pay myself $10 or something like that. And you can just set a scale. I started with a modest scale. If I cooked myself an amazing soup and I ate it that night, I would pay myself maybe $20. If you have a premonitory thought and it actually comes true, you pay yourself for that. You might pay yourself a lot, $100 or $200, right? So at the end of the day, you sit down with your little notebook and you write down the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things that you made a mental note of that day, and you put down a dollar value. This is your spiritual money. And you keep doing it for 1 month. And then you have to see at the end of the month if your spiritual money comes anywhere near your real money. And real money means it could be your salary, it could be anything, bits and pieces that, you know, if people, you know, sell things or they work freelance, as a lot of people do, they do odd jobs. You have to just see what did you actually get in the way of checks and payments, how much did it add up to, and how far apart is it from your spiritual money. And I found to my utter shock that my spiritual money and my real money, the deposits into my checking account, were about $200 apart at the end of the month. And that was a very good month for me. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. They work very close. So I did it for a second month. And my friends, you know, I had been telling a few friends that I was playing this money game and I was explaining to them, and they were pretty skeptical. So they were kind of interested that, because I was a freelancer at the time, that my spiritual money almost matched up to my real deposits. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it for a second month. And this time I'm going to just inflate. I'm going to lay it on. I'm not going to pay myself $20 for a good soup. I'll pay myself $50 or $60 or $70, right? So I just slapped on the spiritual money. Every day I would write down large amounts, considerably larger than what I had paid the month before. And my friends were also interested again, and they were saying, well, so how's it going this month? And, you know, we were only into the second week of the month, and my spiritual money was piling up, but I really, because I was a freelancer and I worked two different kinds of freelance, I really hadn't gotten that much in checks. So I just told my friends, hey, you know, we're only at the middle of the month. There's not, you know, any need to worry yet. So I kept going. And I laid on the spiritual money. I paid myself handsomely for all kinds of things every day that were good. And the third week came, and my spiritual money was way beyond my actual deposit. So I was getting actually a little nervous myself, but not completely. And then I was at one of my freelance jobs. This was now into the third week of the month, and my desk phone rang, and it was my roommate, and he told me we had a horrible flood. The kitchen sink, a hose had broken, and there was an inch of water throughout the house. And I said, oh, so we called the flood control people, and they came, and they ripped up the carpet and set up blowers, and I called my insurance company, and they came, and the adjuster was looking around my house, and she said, well, you have, you know, you're going to need a paint job. I said, why? She said, because look, you have this watermark on the bottom of the floor. I said, on the wall, you know, like an inch above the floor. I said, well, I could touch that up. She said, no, you're going to need a paint job. And look, you have cracked tiles here. You're going to need tile replacement for the whole kitchen. And the list just went on and on. And I said to her, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to do all this. And she said, I don't care. She said, my job is, I'm an adjuster. I have to look at the damage and I have to evaluate it. And then I have to cut you a check. So I said, okay, but listen, I don't need a whole paint job. Just you can pay me for a can of paint and I'll touch up the bottom. She said, nope, I have to pay you for a paint job because you have contiguous walls. You have to paint your whole house. I said, oh my God, all right, do what you have to do. So do you know, they issued me a check for $5,000. And together with my deposits, which were meager that month, that check and my spiritual money, again, matched pretty much. They were about $100 apart. And I could not believe it. And so what this taught me was that we have not learned to value things except in terms of money, and that I had actually trained myself to value the good things that happened to me on a daily basis. I had to train myself to first value them in money before I could really value them, period.
So that's kind of like the world's value to you rather than your value to the world, which is what people sell their labor for.
Right. I had to impose on myself the terms of the world in order to understand what value really was, because that's all I knew. And when I did this twice and I saw, you know, when I actually stretched the envelope and I saw again that it worked, I was starting to get scared. But it changed my consciousness around positivity, and I started to see my life and my days very, very differently. And all I can say is that was a very important lesson. And it continued to work for me in many ways, although I didn't play the money game per se. Actually, I'll tell you this. I had a friend. I taught a lot of my friends the money game, and they were all doing it, but they didn't necessarily do it the way I did it. Some people didn't finish the month, and some people did 1 month, and they didn't do a second. But I had a friend who decided to do it, and she did it seriously. And she called me one day, or I called her, and she said she had had an argument with somebody. And because the argument was ugly, and she faulted herself for it, she felt that she pushed the argument beyond where it should have gone. So she said, "I'm taking $500 away from my spiritual money." And I said, "No, you can't take money away. You can't do that. That's not how it works. You just give yourself money, but you cannot take anything away for negative stuff." And she said, "No, I was terrible to this person, and I shouldn't have said what I said, and I'm taking away $500. Well, do you know what happened to her?
Don't know.
She died.
Right. So, like, if you punish yourself monetarily for messing somebody around, you die if you're playing the money game, you know?
No, you have to. No, it's not. It doesn't boil down to that. She didn't die immediately, but she ended up dying. And I took that very seriously. You cannot take away from the positive that happens in your life.
Well, then it creates spiritual debt.
Right.
All right. And I think this is kind of what people get. What's that place called? Purgatory? Isn't that where people go until the end of time to suffer their spiritual debt, you know?
Well, if you believe in all that. But I think if you want to really retool your mind, look, the perps, the powers that be, when they need money, they simply run a printing press and they have more money. And we just look at a $20 bill or a $100 bill or our bank account, the total, and we freak out and we say, "This is all I have." Well, listen, if for them all they have to do is print more, surely there should be an equivalent for us. And I think the whole fiat currency thing is a fraudulent way to live anyway, but we're kind of stuck in it because we're here and this is how it's done. But if you start valuing yourself and your daily life, I had to do it through that bridge. That's all I can say. I'm not happy that I had to start doing it with money, but I did it, and it took me out of the money band, that value band. I left it. I never was there again.
I've got an interesting juxtaposition to this, because I whinge about money all the time, but only when I really, really need it. And sometimes when I'm not complaining about it, but just think about it, like get up in the morning, go to my computer, think about all the bills that I have to pay that day. I got the rent, the power, the fuel, the food. That's $500. I don't have $500. Log into my computer, into my PayPal, and guess what's in there?
$500
from one guy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I'll be sitting there at my desk at the end of a show, really, really hungry, and think, "Damn, I need a meat pie." And then 2 seconds later, it's my mate Dan, and he's brought me a pie.
So, how do you interpret that?
I interpret that, but because I do a whole lot of good in my day's work, like I publish what people say that ordinarily don't get heard by the media and stuff, that I put a lot of chump change into my spiritual slush fund. And in so doing, whenever I do need something, what I want is more than I need. And I will always get exactly what I need, but I will never get what I want.
Well, maybe the word want is at fault then. I mean, I don't think the New Age is all stupid. I think some of the things they teach are actually very interesting.
But can I sum up the New Age movement in three sentences? You know the Lord Acton quote? Great power, what was it? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, that quote by itself sounds like a really good quote, doesn't it? Just like the New Age movement sounds really good. But there's a third line in that quote that actually makes the quote a hell of a lot more relevant that normally doesn't get said to people or explained. All great men are inherently evil. So when you take any idea, and if somebody explains to you the good sides of it, but they leave out certain parts, like the responsibility element and the ability to influence the 3D world by acting within it, as well as your spiritual energy, and not trying to separate the two to make sure that your fate and your body and your mind are entwined. That's what it should be, but it's not. It becomes a detachment from reality for some people who choose to never look at things that scare them because they believe that any kind of negativity, any kind of reality that they're not happy with, simply isn't worth listening to.
Right. They don't want to ruin their fine minds, like Barbara Bush said.
I saw a quote on Facebook today, something along the lines of, if I was less aware, I'd be more happy. And I think that maybe, just like I misuse the word want, people misuse the word happy. They think happiness is something other than what it is.
Well, they want it to be a permanent state, but a long time ago I came across the idea that our emotions are actually the vehicles or tools for our goals. In other words, you set certain goals, and if you are always negative and always angry and always in a funk, your emotions are really the power in you, of you, for you. When you're sailing and you're, you know, going strong, happy or whatever you want to call it, then you have a much better outlook and a better chance of making use of opportunities and drawing to you other opportunities. So I really think our emotions are the vehicle or path to the things that we quote-unquote want or want to create. I mean, I think ultimately we are creative. Actually, I shouldn't say ultimately. I should say foundationally, fundamentally, we're creative beings. We're creatures of intention and creation, but we've been reduced into creatures of reaction and response and fear because that part of us has become very dormant, the intention creation part. It's just a very fleeting thing in most of us now. And so all we do is sit here and, experience the prods and pricks of the New World Order and all of the difficulties that it's constantly imposing on us. And we cry out and scream and rail and moan and twist and writhe, but we don't think that we could actually put intention out there and let it go. And I think the first thing is intention, the second thing is emotion. You really have to use your emotions as tools.
Well, your emotions are kind of like a they can be a weapon. you know? I mean, you ever seen somebody get really angry and say something they don't mean and really, really hurt somebody?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think this is what has happened to society is somehow our emotions have become weaponized.
Well, yeah, because it's realized and recognized that our emotions are really very powerful creative tools. They're the second leg of creativity, and that is known. So it has been decided that fear should be the prevailing emotion in us and will never create.
Yeah, and that's one thing that psychopaths don't have, ladies and gentlemen, the ability to create from nothing.
Right. They mimic and they covet and they seek to take something that you started or that you made. And
then threaten you if you say, I actually started it and I made it and you were just there and you stole the idea off me, you scumbag.
Right, because they have the legal system. That's another big game.
Which all react to protect each other like antibodies and white blood cells attack a virus. Anybody who tries to expose their industry or anybody within their industry that might lead to something else. Pew!
You know, when you said about looking in PayPal after you do a show and you think how many bills you have, well, I've had situations very much like that. I remember once I did not have enough money to pay the rent. And I was really scared. And I went to do my... It was in the winter, so I walk on the beach a lot because it's really stormy and blustery. And it was a gray day and really nice. I like those gray days with the wind blowing. And anyway, so I was scared of this whole financial reality. And I decided to just take my walk. I said, I'm just going to take my walk. Is there anything right now, in the here and now? I mean, I don't have to pay the rent right now. It's not due until Monday. So is there anything that should ruin my walk? And the answer was no, just nothing. Everything is fine right now. So I took this walk and I actually ran into a guy. He was an older man and he had a terrible accident with his knee. He was a track coach and some kid had thrown the shot, you know, I guess you call it putting the shot right into his knee, and it had shattered his knee. And so he could never run after that, and the best he could do was walk, and he had this terrible arthritis. And I listened to him. We walked 6 miles, and I listened to him the whole way, gave him some suggestions, and I realized I had actually been very supportive, and he had probably benefited somewhat from this talk we had. Anyway, I got in my car after that, and I thought, oh, God, the rent, what am I going to do? Anyway, so I drove home, went to my mailbox, opened it, just, you know, with dread, because there are always bills. And amazingly, one of my freelance clients had paid me early, and they never paid early. In fact, the bookkeeper was somebody that I was sure had it in for me because she made me wait weeks to get paid. And amazingly, here was this check sitting there and it was early and I had the money I needed.
It happens to me like on a daily basis. Like just today, for example, there's no food in the house at all, but you know where there is food? At the organic shop up the road. And you know how much they charge for a lunch? Exactly $5 New Zealand. How much money did I have in my wallet? $5 New Zealand. I got no other money at all, but I had enough for lunch. And guaranteed tonight at dinner, some kind of food is going to turn up or something of that nature. You know, I kind of like live on this, but the problem is when you're thinking about point B, but you're still at point A, it's when you think that you're in between, but you're really still at point A that really, really kind of starts to generate anxiety. Because you're reaching for something that you can't quite grasp yet. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like reaching out for your desires and not obtaining them forces you to live in a state of perpetual anxiety. And I think that's why television has put put our desires out in front of us for all to see. All the beautiful girls, all the nice cars, all the great clothes. Everything. So desirable. And yet you'll never obtain it, will you? You'll never be able to reach out into that TV screen and pluck what's on there, will you? You listen to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, my very special guest. Oh my goodness! My absolutely fabulous guest.
Yes.
It's Sophia Small Storm. And she's about as small a storm as Katrina. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the extravaganza, like Tony Danza, of The Vinnie Eastwood Show. And my very spectacular, somewhat miraculous guest.
Oh, come on.
Is Sophia. I'm just laying it on.
Good. Thanks.
It's fun, isn't it? And
yeah.
And we were just telling you over the break about, you've got the money game. Well, I have a rage problem, so I play the counting game if I'm stuck at a red light. I just estimate how long that light's going to take to go green for me or until the car starts moving. And almost every time now, that since I've started doing it, because I've got no radio in my car, I've got nothing to distract me, can't get the bastard to work. And almost every single time now, by the time I've counted to one, my car has started to move.
By itself?
No. And even on my way home now, I was just really impatient. I need to get home for the interview, but turns out I was a bit early. But I was stuck behind a slow driver, and I estimated 60 seconds. It's going to take me 60 seconds from here to get into my driveway. By the time I got down, counted down to one, I literally pulled onto my driveway. And I think I've actually been able to do this for quite some time. When I was in, I think I might have been 12, we went to go my dad's batch out in the Coromandel Beach, about 3 hours' drive from where we are now. And we were over one side of the mountains. We had to get over the mountains to get to the beach. And my sister goes, okay, how long is it going to take? And without batting an eyelash, I said 79 minutes and set my watch counter. And again, the second it hit 79 minutes, we rolled onto the beach.
You are good. Hey, how long is it going to take to the end of the world?
I don't know. 28 weeks.
Don't say it. All right. I didn't want to put that thought out there, but, you know.
No, that was just a movie reference, actually, to the movie 28 Weeks Later.
Oh, yeah. I heard of that once. How about to the reversal of the New World Order? The waking up of humanity.
Well, to be honest, I can't actually take that in terms of a thing, because it's not like a distance. It's not like a mechanism. There's a lot of different things involved and a lot of unforeseen circumstance. What I do know is that the awakening and the dissolution of the New World Order is already happening. And so we don't need to wait. We just need to participate.
Yes. You can be part of the problem and you can sit in the matrix, or you can be part of the active, awake solution.
Which is, i.e., part of the problem for the guys in charge.
And yeah.
I don't know about you, but I actually love being part of the problem. If there's some kind of really nasty person doing some nasty thing, and I can just make his day just that little bit worse, it makes me feel good about myself. I don't know. Maybe that's sadistic, but I call it doing the right thing.
Well, I think there are differences in male and female attitudes and thoughts. I mean, this is a really, it's a male-dominated world, the activism world. You won't find that many women in it. I mean, you will. They'll be passing out information and doing the quiet advising and telling people what's going on, but it's very male dominated otherwise, I have found.
Could I illustrate this?
Yeah.
every month we have a little get-together at my house, you know, just to get a few activists and listeners and things like that just around to have a drink or not drink or whatever, and just have a conversation, more or less, right? And I basically have to twist people's arms to get them to bring women. Because otherwise it's just my wife and me and a whole bunch of other guys, you know? And it really is absolutely fundamentally true. And the listening audience stats show it as well. The listening for talk radio is overwhelmingly women. Overwhelmingly male. The amount of talk show hosts, overwhelmingly male. It really is a man's game at the end of the day. The successful female talk radio show hosts that I know that do it very, very regularly generally have very more baritone sort of voices as well. They're a bit deeper. And see? And it's the same thing with politics, activism, and things of that nature. What is this phenomenon, do you think, Sophia? In fact, if you'll give me a second while you try to explain it, a guy called Dr. Sam Shea, in fact, had a slide on this. I'm just going to quickly find it for us. So why do you think this this whole activism scene is so male-dominated?
Well, I was just told this weekend by someone about something called aromatase, and I haven't looked it up. Every fat cell has aromatase in it, but I did get far enough in my research this morning to learn that fat is all part of the endocrine system. So it appears that fat will work very hard at converting testosterone into estrogen. And a fat man, a very fat man, can have more estrogen in his body than a woman, because he has that many fat cells and they all have this aromatase in them. So I was doing some thinking, and I'm going to research this more over the next few days, but this guy that was telling me all this told me that testosterone makes you happy. It makes you confident. And the fatter you are as a male, the less confident you are, the more your muscles will atrophy. You'll actually have what looks like little breasts. You'll be giggly, bald, all kinds of stuff that really is about feminization. And so the males who have kept their testosterone going, and I think, you know, it's almost like exercising. If you use a muscle, then it continues to be strong. So I think that it takes some testosterone to do this activism in a public way. And one thing that
I so have to interject here. I'm very sorry, Sophia. You're going to need to hold that thought.
All right.
Because I found the slide, and it really fits in exactly what you're saying here. This is left brain versus right brain. Left equals male, right equals female. Now, here's the traits of the male. Testosterone, whereas the female's got estrogen. Male uses logic, whereas female uses feeling. Male takes action, whereas a female is prone to thinking. A male is detail-oriented, whereas a female is big-picture-oriented. With a man, facts rule, with a female, imagination rules. With man, words and language. With women, it's symbols and images. With man, the stronger brain connection to rest and digest, or parasympathetics. And for a woman, the stronger brain connection to fight or flight, or sympathetics. Now, just think about those male attributes in terms of activism, in terms of talk radio. There's testosterone, logic, action, details, facts, words, language, stronger brain connection, you know?
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense.
And then have a look at what would you say is a very female-oriented field of work, like, say, teaching, for example. Lots of female teachers that's using feeling, thinking, big picture, imagination, symbols and images.
Well, females are noted for nurturing. They have greater nurturing tendencies than men, and men have more sexualization and aggression than females do. So that's really where the split is. Now, I'll tell you something very interesting, and I've seen this play out. If you put your hand in front of you and you look at it, and I'm not the palm, the other side, the back, and you compare the length of your index finger and your ring finger, the traditional male hand, heterosexual male hand, will have a longer ring finger and a shorter index finger. And the traditional female hand, heterosexual female, will have a longer index finger compared to the ring finger. And interestingly, gay women and gay men will have the hand of the other sex. So the length of the ring finger is a marker of how much testosterone you have in your system.
So are you saying homosexuality isn't a choice? It's just the hand that they were dealt?
Ha ha, yes. I have the typically male hand. I have a much longer ring finger than index finger. And I'm not gay or lesbian, but I am athletic. So it appears that athletic females tend to have the longer, they have the male hand. And all my life, when I was younger, I would look at my hand and think, why is there such a difference between my ring finger and my index finger? It's a quarter of an inch. And I'd look at other people's hands. I'd look at in magazines and pictures of women's hands, and they all had this long index finger. And I think it boils down to grip strength. You need a long ring finger to complete the power in the grip. And I used to be a good tennis and racket sport player because you can grip the racket all that much better if you have this long ring finger. It gives you strength in the bottom of your grip because you have this weak pinky otherwise. So anyway, I thought this was very interesting. And I've looked at people's hands, and increasingly with this feminization of men, and this is what Professor Daryl Hamamoto has brought to my attention, the complete change of the biology of males in today's world. He has encountered young adult males who weep and tell him and cry that they are not gay, they're not straight, they don't know what they are, they don't have any sex drive, there's something in between that they are, and they don't know what it is. And there is a very, very concerted effort to create half-baked males, to bring them toward the feminine, away from the masculine. And I'll tell you what I have researched that I think explains this. But you were about to say something.
I once asked Dr. Catherine Albrecht, is there anything she sometimes thinks about but she never mentions on radio because it's too controversial? And she said, pharmaceutical drugs that turn people gay.
Well, I don't know about those.
It was incredible. She started laying out these articles and things like that of these guys who had taken like three, four times their dose or something like that, and then gone and had a homosexual escapade, and then like eloped to New York or something out of Connecticut, and then woken up like a couple of days later wondering what the heck was going on.
Really?
Just amazing stuff.
Well, I'll tell you this. I did some reading about conception, and you're familiar with the idea that we have xenoestrogens in our plastics, right? Plastics, the phthalates and the BPA, they're all estrogen mimickers.
Bisophenylalanines and all the inks. When I go through and I buy anything at a shop that's got like those printed receipts, I tell them, you know, try to not touch the ink, man. It'll give you breast cancer or give you, you know, man boobies.
Right. It's not even just the ink. It's the coating. It's a bisphenol A brominated plastic coating that makes those receipts shiny. Hmm. And that's that. I was at a grocery store once, Trader Joe's, and there were six checkers standing there. They were all male, all bald, all in their 30s or 20s. And they were all handling these receipts all day. And I said to my guy who was ringing me up, I said, don't touch that thing. I'll take it. And he said, why? I said, because it's feminizing you. I said, just turn around. Look at all your buddies. Nobody has any hair. How old are you all? And he didn't, you know, he didn't know this. And he was a little shocked. But anyway, so here's what happens. Every baby upon conception, whether the sperm carries an X chromosome or a Y chromosome, determines the sex of that baby, right? So the human embryo is either XX, it's going to be a girl, because the sperm that came in was an X chromosome sperm, or it's going to be a boy, in which case it's XY, because the sperm that came in and penetrated, the first to win the race, was an X, was a Y carrying sperm. So all embryos are female for the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. And then it's the job of the Y chromosome to pull out of that original initial female form what makes a male. So in the seventh week of pregnancy, the little male gonads and reproductive organs start to form and the male brain starts to develop. But if this is my contention. If the environment in the womb is not right, if it's imperfect, if it's off, then that completion, which occurs from the seventh week to the 39th to 44th week of pregnancy, that completion doesn't take place. And what's happening today is the rate of male miscarriage, boy babies being miscarried, is huge. And the rate of boy babies, you know, basically they're dying in the womb when they're miscarried. The body is rejecting, saying, this isn't going to work. We have to stop and we have to start again some other time. Then you also have a very high incidence of hermaphrodite babies being born, which have the genitals of both sexes. So this strikes me as being, again, an incomplete job. The Y chromosome cannot pull a male fully out of that initial female form. Or you get homosexuals, and which are rates of homosexuality incidence is much, much higher now than it ever was. And it's very possible that these are incomplete males. They're males with female brains, males with female tendencies, males that haven't fully developed because that internal environment wasn't quite right. And so I explain the internal environment. Let's say the mother is full of phthalates and xenoestrogens. She's been, you know, using plastics, and lots of these personal care products have phthalates in them. The shampoos that make your hair all shiny, they have plasticizers. And we use all kinds of soft plastics and hard plastics, and they all are estrogen mimickers. So let's say the mother's bloodstream is full of these chemicals, and that's where the baby is getting its nourishment. So it's getting a lot of influence, and it's not able to become a full male. So anyway, that to me explains this professor's you know, his anecdotes about the students that he has encountered who are very upset because they don't know what they are.
Do you believe that there's an element within society that is deliberately doing this?
Yes.
And if so, what's their end game? Why?
Well, it's all toward the post-human society. The element, as you refer to it, wants to stop, break down the nuclear family, because that's the tightest ring in the chain. And they've already succeeded in doing that with divorce, and, you know, television has been a tremendous intrusion into our lives, and then all the trends, the marketing, the hypersexualization of everybody. Anyway, the friction between men and women in general. But to feminize the men is a very important thing in this plan because it takes that aggressive nature way, way, way down. And you're not going to get a lot of resistance from men who are more so, female.
Hold on a second. I remember that there was some kind of Indian village or something in America when all the men went out during the day and the cavalrymen rolled in and they killed all the women and children because there were no real men around to defend them.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? They're trying to do that on sort of like a society-wide level, so it's kind of like all the men have left the village and leaving everybody vulnerable?
Yeah, if they turn the men into women, then they don't have the male defense. They don't have the male resistance in the society. And I learned only this weekend about this, I forgot what it's called, aromatase, that fat cells have aromatase in them, and the job of aromatase is to convert testosterone into estrogen. That was new for me. So, you know, I'm only telling you what somebody told me, but he's very, very thorough. He does a lot of research, and I think he probably knows his stuff. I have to keep going. I studied fat today, and I learned about brown fat and white fat and visceral fat and subcutaneous fat and all this other stuff. But I understood from my preliminary research that fat is part of the endocrine system. It was never viewed as such, but it is. It's a hormonal component.
Might be part of the reason why a whole bunch of cannabis cells actually get stored up in the fat or something like that, because it's used as a nutrient or something. There's a cannabinoid molecule that can morph into certain different types of, it can basically mimic nutrients, different types of nutrients, and your cells have receptors in them that send signals out to the cannabinoid molecules and tell them what kind of nutrients it requires. And the molecule morphs into them. Yeah, it's endocannabinoids, I think. It was Dr. Bob Malamed, who's doing a lot of tours of major U.S. universities as well at the minute. He's a big advocate of Rick Simpson's work, who's developed the high-potency THC hemp oil, which you can apply to, say, skin cancers. This is how he found out about it in the first place, just applying the oil to a skin cancer on his nose. And after a while, the skin cancer came off, and he went to the doctor, and they told him he was cured. So he started doing it to a whole lot of other people, and he found out he can cure pretty much anything.
All right.
Yeah. PhoenixTears.ca, very interesting stuff. Anyway, we're coming very much to the lesser end of the broadcast now. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience, Sophia? Perhaps something, you know, you've never shared before, or don't talk about it because it's even more controversial, you know?
Now you just stalled me completely. It was such a huge open question. I can talk about things all the time, and there are lots of things I've never talked about on the air. I never talked about the money game on the air. Maybe people think it's stupid, but nice thing about you is that you're a very flexible host, just as you said you were.
I am the gymnast of talk radio.
That's nice. I like that because I don't have to cite a whole bunch of, you know, science, although I did a little bit tonight.
Well, see, that stuff's good. Sometimes the general idea is more valuable than the details.
Right. It's the concept that we have to start putting together, and we have to start refitting them in new and creative ways. We have to realize that we're a lot more potent than we think we are. We're not weak and full of estrogen and quiet.
I feel like I am kind of at some point turning into some form of wussy, you know. Well, In a little bit of a kind of way. But you know how I balance that out? By going out to protests and yelling angrily through a megaphone for several hours. That gets your testosterone and your adrenaline up.
Well, sure, because you're participating in a real life, public. It can work you really up, really work you up. I went to protests when they had the whole Iraq war thing, and I remember marching with the crowd and thinking, this is amazing. I would never do such things otherwise. But yeah, the crowd energy, it's very uplifting.
It is, especially when you're making them laugh with really terrible jokes through a megaphone that, for some reason, because they're said through a megaphone, they're no longer terrible jokes and the crowd actually laughs. I don't know, I understand the mechanism here, but it works somehow. It's really fun. It really is.
I think it's your personality. I think you just have a knack for this. You were born to do this.
Well, I was kind of born to entertain, you know. I was just thinking about this. I saw a interview that George Carlin did, and he said when he was a boy, he wanted to be like a radio disc jockey. He wanted to be a talk radio show host. He wanted to be a performer. He wanted to be an actor or something. And he realized later in life, when he was about 40 or 50, that when he was a boy, everything he wanted to do was to be in front of other people and entertain them. And he became a stand-up comedian and been in a few acting roles and things like that. And it's funny that he mentioned that, because that's exactly how I felt as a boy and still feel now. And I'm merely just acting out my boyhood fantasy. And by God, when your fantasy becomes reality, does reality no longer suck? Because you're no longer denying your true self.
Right, you're doing your dharma.
Or my Greg. We'll be right. Speaking of which, Sophia, do you have any websites or things of that nature you'd like to plug before we go?
AboutTheSky.com. My store is AvatarProducts.com. I really want people to pay attention to wireless exposure. Maybe I'll do a show with you on that sometime, because I have some different ways of putting it.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, you want to? Okay.
Sure. All right. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, probably after the break, with Suzanne Posel. Catch you again. Thank you, Sophia.